Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. I'm Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the Professional Committee. When the Professional Committee met to discuss our guest today, it was one of the more uproarious meetings when another committee member, I won't say who, said, "Oh, I was in Wan Chai a while back, and the earth moved." And we were very unsure why what the story was that led to that, but we did decide that we really needed this guest because we a number of us have been wondering why is it that you don't hear more about earthquake preparations in Hong Kong. I'll never forget going to a dinner party about 6 years ago and sitting next to a Hong Kong University geologist who said, "Oh, Hong Kong's absolutely at high seismic risk. Mid-levels would be a tremendous landslide area in the event of an earthquake, but nobody really worries about it here. In fact, there are no earthquake standards." And so with that background, we were very interested in hearing from Dr. Ian McPheat-Smith. He's somebody with decades of experience as a civil engineer. He's worked on tunneling, but he's particularly become interested, given his knowledge of underground structures and of the geology of Hong Kong, he's been particularly interested in this place's sensitivity to an earthquake. And with that, I'd like to give you to him. One note beforehand, just housekeeping, please, if you could all turn off your cell phones or mute them now if you haven't already done so. We are videotaping it. We now put up all of our speakers with their consent on YouTube, and we'll be doing so for this as well. And a cell phone going off really disrupts things. And with that, here's our speaker. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Keith. Ladies and gentlemen, this presentation concerns Epicenter Hong Kong. It's about the effect of a large earthquake in Hong Kong. It is a novel, and my wife is selling some copies at the door there. Having said that, it sails very close to the wind. We won't dwell too much on the novel, but there's been an introduction in the handout that you've had. We'll certainly look at government's position. We'll look at the issues of regional seismicity, crustal subsidence in the Pearl River estuary, and look at some form of risk analysis. We'll also consider man-made intervention and how that influences earthquakes, threats from other natural causes, and finally, we'll have a brief look at government's plans for natural disasters. Now, I'm an engineering geologist. I've worked here for a long time, since deep tunnel projects since 1978, and now I work at senior level on risk management to look at the effects of our construction on the environment and so on, and vice versa. By the way, the novel is a part of a trilogy. I just haven't had the courage to write the third part. And the novel begs the question, are we really vulnerable here in Hong Kong? I believe we are. I believe that we are a big, fat, sitting duck. And this slide illustrates it. We keep building these reclamations at 6 meters above sea level. Sea level is changing. I understand that the North Sea has risen by 6 inches in the last 20 years and is rising a lot further. For example, sea levels are rising. And I think we have to start understanding that. But we're also at risk from other sources, particularly the sea, but not exclusively. So the novel was written to eliminate our natural assumption that Hong Kong is sitting in this safe, static part of the Earth's crust, and that we're somehow immune from earthquakes, that our money protects us. Well, it might buy you insurance, but I'm not sure it's going to protect you physically. The novel certainly challenges the complacency that exists in the community, amongst us, all of us, but particularly Hong Kong governments, because they have collective responsibility which I hope they do realize. It presents new evidence that, in fact, that this risk is intolerable, and it brings into question the codes of practice for building design and calls for mitigation measures to be put into place for our protection. I'm not exactly the first person on the planet that has come to the conclusion Hong Kong's at risk. Andrew Robinson, in his book Earthshock, mentioned it in 2002 and placed Hong Kong on a list of large cities at risk from earthquakes around the world. Interestingly, Andrew has not mentioned Christchurch. I'm sure many of you are aware of the events down at Christchurch. Nor has he mentioned New York. So why then are the authorities up in arms in New York about risk from earthquakes? They've never had an earthquake. They're not at the edge of a plate boundary. Why are they concerned? Because there's 11 million people in New York, because they're in a flat piece of land, and because they have 100,000 high-rise buildings. They realise the risk. They're in better geological conditions than us, and they're doing something about it. We are not. At stake in Hong Kong is Asia's finest infrastructure, the world's largest container port. 60,000 high-rise buildings which are past their shelf life, past their use-by date. Buildings are built with 30 to 50 years design life. We started building in the 50s or 60s, pretty obvious. What's more, the construction of some of these buildings have a big question mark over them. What kind of buildings? Housing department buildings. Of course, there's the integrity of a nuclear power station, which has been stuck just across the border there, upwind. The lives of 7 million people, which I mentioned, by the way, not to mention the very survival of Hong Kong itself. I believe in extreme circumstances, Hong Kong might fail to exist should we experience a large earthquake. Fukushima, many of you will be aware of the events there. I was certainly talking to Keith about it over lunch. We heard a lot of information. I saw, well after the partial meltdowns of Units 1 and 2, I saw university professors telling us all sorts of spiel, and they were just not correct. They were misinformed, and as we were duped. And the New York Times reported it, I believe. Anyway, so at times of national emergency, can we believe our government or nuclear power corporations? Fortunately, we have no major faults in Hong Kong. Right? Well, not quite right. We have a lot of major faults in Hong Kong. We have, let me see if I can get my pointer working. Here we go. The Shenzhen Fault. Now, the coast of China runs northeast, southwest. Okay? These faults run parallel to the coastline, and they've given rise to the shape of our coastline. The Shenzhen Fault is a big one that runs right through the new territories, through Deep Bay, Castle Peak, and so on. And the other big one is Lantau. There's also another one that runs, starting at Dahye Bay, runs through the Tolo Channel. It's the Tolo Fault. It runs through Chun Wan, Shatin, Chun Wan. It digresses and gives rise to that funny triangular shape of Lantau. One leaf goes through Chun Wan and Chek Lak Kok. The other goes to the east of Lantau. The other large fault I should mention is the one which is running perpendicular to this, which has given rise to the shape of the Pearl River estuary. We'll come back to that one in a moment. That is the biggest single feature in the coast of China, other than Hainan Island. It is massive, 140 kilometres long, 50 kilometres at its mouth between here and Macau. It's a massive estuary. Okay, the Tolo Fault gives rise to these areas, these valleys, the Kowloon group of reservoirs, Shatin, the Tolo Channel, And the other way, as I mentioned, it goes out through Chicxulub and to the east of Lantau as it digresses. I've worked in deep tunnels. I've been responsible as the geologist, monitoring conditions. We're talking about big faults here. They're 150 metres wide. They've given us all sorts of difficulties for construction of the tunnels. So I think you'll concede, okay, we've got larger faults in Hong Kong, but we all know they're not seismically active, right? Well, not quite. There's a lot of micro seismic activity occurring. Usually every day there's an event in Hong Kong. The whole of the Earth's surface is moving. Now, this is a plot taken over 6 years, as I recall, from 79 to 85. Okay, it's only 6 years movement. And you can see clusters. Let's see, here's Hong Kong Island. You can see a cluster at Lama, and that's large-scale blasting which has caused those events. Okay? However, if you look around all over Hong Kong, you'll find a lot of events which are nowhere near land. No one blasts under the sea. Okay? It's highly expensive, and you can't get the muck out very easily. And look at this lot up at Deep Bay here, right along the line of the Shenzhen Fault. There's also alineations running along the fault lines I mentioned previously. So there's a lot of movement along faults. If we pick some of the biggest of those, 1982, we had two micro earthquake occurring to the east of Lantau. We had Mai Po. We had one in Mai Po. That Mai Po marshes, that's along the Shenzhen Fault. Interestingly enough, three on East Lantau in 1995. What were we doing in 1995? We were building an airport. Huge reclamation works. Coincidence? I don't know. But put your dollar on it, your last dollar on it, the Hong Kong government don't know either. Coincidence? Maybe. Right, Dapeng Peninsula, where's that? Oh, it's up at Daya Bay. Dangang Island on this fault zone, Deep Bay again on the Shenzhen fault. In other words, a lot of these activities, the bigger ones, are related to faults. Our faults are seismically active, so far in a small way. Now, the Hong Kong government's position is that Hong Kong is not located close to the edge of a plate boundary and is therefore not subject to seismic activity. That is true. Interestingly enough, a lot of earthquakes do occur mid-plate. What's more, when they do occur, they're magnified. They're magnified because they haven't had earthquakes previously. What's more, Christchurch is being rattled to get death, I assume it's still going on, by a lot of micro-earthquakes, mini-earthquakes. Statistics, according to the Hong Kong government, show that Hong Kong has never experienced a major earthquake. Correct. To date, we've had some at 6 at He Yuan Reservoir to south of Lantau back in 1874. We've had a couple of big ones up and down the coast within 350 kilometres from us along these fault lines. Now, up at here's our northeast-southwest trending fault lines at Sha Tau and at Hainan Island. We've had a few along in Hong Kong itself. We just, by coincidence, haven't had a major earthquake here. So far, conditions haven't been quite right. Now, about 10 years ago, I was told by Civil Engineering Department that the risk of having an earthquake was low. Interestingly enough, it was changed to low to medium then. Why? Why was it changed? Well, I believe there was no major studies then. I believe it was changed because of public perception. And there's other words for public perception. Public acceptability, public gullibility. Tell the people what you want them to believe. Anyway, there's big question marks in this. Accordingly, our codes of practice for buildings assume that typhoon loading is sufficient to protect us from earthquake activity. Absolute poppycock. absolute nonsense. Typhoon loading is a force. Earthquake movement is literally the ground moves like this, and buildings act like accordions that not, they don't have a force. I've seen structural engineers from, I won't mention the company's names, tell us information which is actually quite wrong. Okay, so with so much at stake, why is our protection here based on historical records alone? Who of you here drives a car without forward, without looking at the, without looking through the windscreen? Do we drive a car looking only in our rear view mirror? Do we look to the past to tell us which way we're going in the future? Obviously not. We are at the edge of a huge coastline shaped by these fault lines. They've had big earthquakes up and down the coast. We know nothing about the geology at depth in the Earth's crust, and we are in a region of change. That change is illustrated by a huge rainfall we had due to a volcanic activity in Chile. We had in 2008 a 1 in 1100 year rainfall. How could we have that? The answer was change. Something happened. Clouds came from Chile, dumped all the water on South Lantau with 2,400 landslides on Lantau. Happened to know it because I live there. Anyway, change occurs in different ways. One is the straw on the camel's back. That implies gravity. So if you have something delicately balanced and you put a feather here, your whole thing can tip, despite the fact that it's a massive structure. We can have a trigger effect. That implies we've got built up energy and we have a very small movement which releases massive energy, or change can occur through accumulation of known and unknown factors. So what do we know? What does the GEO know about the depth of geology in Hong Kong? The answer is they've never investigated it. It's not convenient. However, change does occur. Man-made seismicity is a reservoir-triggered seismicity is an accepted science. So 790 cases around the world. The most recent, according to Scientist magazine, it happened at Sichuan, where you have the filling of a huge reservoir and 69,000 people died in that event. So it does happen. And then I come back to the issue of what happened at Chek Lak Kok during the reclamation. Now, the Pearl River estuary is an area of constant change, sedimentation, deposition, and so on. From studies done at the university, they drilled 30 boreholes and they found a mismatch from the strata at the side to the strata in the middle of the estuary by 15 to 20 metres. In other words, the whole of the estuary is dropped by 15 to 20 metres in recent years. They refer to it in the paper as crustal subsidence. This was Professor Wiss Yim, Professor Lau, and others. That's the facts. Is that stability? Are we in an area of stability when the whole of this massive estuary is dropped by 15 to 20 metres? I wouldn't call it stability. Risk management. Risk has to be considered from two points of view, not just frequency. You assess risk by considering both likelihood and consequence. Okay? If you are in a greenfield site and you have an earthquake, a massive earthquake, you will likely be unaffected by it. If there's 7 million people there and you're in among 60,000 high-rise buildings with a massive, anyway, with all sorts of structures and so on, the consequences will be multiplied by that number. In other words, the risk to people in Hong Kong is 7 million times the risk to the individual. So risk increases. Now, if we have a large earthquake in Hong Kong, I'll show you some pictures in a minute, I believe the effect will be catastrophic. So in other words, instead of being on this line, we will be on this line in the high to intolerable risk levels. The government's position is that we are at low to medium risk. I believe it's medium to high. In either case, we're looking at an extremely high risk or an intolerable risk by virtue of our population and population density. 280,000 people per square kilometre in Mong Kok. What happens when they run out of water? I'm jumping the gun here a bit. Okay, consequences of a large earthquake close to Hong Kong. I think we've seen the pictures. It's happened up the road. Fire, Tsing Yi is one obvious place where you would experience this sort of thing. Reclamations, subject to liquefaction, airports disappearing, waterlogged, fires in housing areas, loss of transportation systems, roads, slope instability. They don't have big slopes in New York. We do. Total chaos and impossibility of access. So the key factor that makes us so vulnerable here in Hong Kong is our population density. As simple as that. 280,000 people. What happens when the water gets shut off? When there's power cuts? The answer is they take to the streets. You will. And if you're in Mong Kok or Kowloon Tong or wherever, and you're competing with that number of people for water, well, park and shop, apart from the putting guards with armed guns, they're not going to. Law and order is not going to stay. It will break down, and it will break down very, very quickly. I could paint the scenario. The book paints the scenario much better with more space. Without jobs, are we really going to stay here? No employment? Who wants to stay here? Come to my resort, Punta Riviera Resort, just across in Philippines, and sip a pina colada with me and say, isn't it terrible what happened to Hong Kong? Who wants to stay in this gloom and misery if we have a serious earthquake? No jobs, remember that. Other threats, tsunamis, 2004, we're well aware what happened. Okay, moving on. Keith, we're aware also of what happened in Japan and how the coastal defences were breached. If we have an R9 earthquake in the Manila Trench, we will get 2 hours warning. Excuse me jumping so fast, but my timekeeper's on my bike. 2 hours warning, we're talking about a 6 metre high wave with 2 hours warning. 2 hours warning is not 2 hours warning. It's 2 hours after the event, not 2 hours after we discover it. And you can't just go upstairs and hide from it. So that would be the south coast. Solar magnetic flares certainly have happened. The last one was 1875 in the United States. The warning there is 15 to 20 meters. Other threats, the volcanic eruption looms large. And I think Lackey is the best example. Back in 1793, for 3 years, the earth had no vegetation, no livestock. The French Revolution took place in 1798. Was that coincidence? Of course it wasn't. People were upset. So what would happen today if we get another volcanic eruption like we did back then? With our population. Well, some of you must have read The Road. No Country for Old Men? Fascinating. Anyway, I'll refer you to that book. James Lovelock gives us 40 years for global warming. That's too big a subject for me. Governments' emergency plans for all sorts of natural disasters. Well, they all kind of think about it and they all phone each other and they say, well, what we're going to do, we'll blame the Drainage Services Department. That's what appears to be. I've looked through the website at what the plans are and it appears there's no actual plans for anything there. No clear lines of responsibility, no clear roles. Chaos is certain, 100% guaranteed. Should we have a natural disaster? We are a big fat duck. And have a look at our government stores for natural disasters. 1,000 woolen blankets. Well, what I would do with that is issue them to government departments down at Tamar and let them use them as parachutes to come off the roof. White disinfectant in 25-litre drums, who wants to carry those? Chloride of lime, tuberias, of course, sandbags, 10,000 empty, and 1.3 million empty syringes. Very useful. Anyway, so the bottom line is there are a few unscathed survivors from natural disasters. Excuse me, I'm laughing. It's more nerves than amusement. Who's going to come and help us? In the local event, maybe we'll get help, but how long will it come and take? How long will it take to get here? We have to help ourselves. And we can do that. It's not a hopeless case. Minimizing the risk from natural disasters require conducting appropriate investigations, carrying out independent views of our codes of practice, building safe havens, having emergency stores which are appropriate, first aid kits, water purification, containers to carry things, creating realistic emergency and contingency plans. There is light at the end of the corridor. We should be prepared for such major catastrophic events. So
thank you.
The message here, Keith, to round up, is there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our government's philosophy. I don't have all of the answers here in this book, just some of the right questions. This is just a starting point for asking questions. And the purpose of this book is to raise our level of awareness, our level, government's level of awareness, of the risks posed by natural disasters. That's the book. It's the first in the trilogy. As I say, I haven't had the courage to write the second and the third one yet. Thank you very much.
Thank you. With that, why don't we throw open the floor for questions? Actually, just one note, actually, that you didn't mention. There was the long study by a group of geologists, international group of geologists, that was summarized in National Geographic a month ago, concluded that Hong Kong was one of the world's high risk. Actually, it was only a half dozen cities around the world they mentioned, particularly for tsunami risk. You didn't mention.
I did mention tsunamis, yes.
Okay, tsunamis, but that particular study just came out.
And that risk comes from the
Manila Trench, exactly.
And I mentioned we get 2 hours warning if we have an R9 in the Richter scale type earthquake.
Yeah. Okay, with that, why don't we throw it open for questions? Please identify yourselves. Back there, please.
Matthew Flynn, Alchemy, Asia. In terms of your experience, obviously you've looked at this fairly deeply. Do you see any other localities as being, role models for catastrophic preparedness?
Well, I've looked largely at Hong Kong because I live here and I understand the local geology to some extent. I've watched Peril TV. I was featured in a presentation there. They looked at the Manila Trench tsunami and they were concerned about the region. That's inside the South China Sea, not outside. But that book by Andrew Robinson lists 40 cities which are at risk. But remember what I'm saying, we are at risk because we are getting bigger. Our cities are getting more populated. We're becoming big, fat, helpless ducks.
So my question is,
yes, sir.
Do you see any cities are any cities better prepared than others, and what lessons could be learned from those cities?
I would like to think that Singapore is better prepared than us. They are certainly, they built these nuclear power shelters which double up in rock caverns, and they double up for protection against national emergency. War isn't an impossibility here in Hong Kong. And so these cavern facilities in Singapore do double up. New York, as I mentioned, is starting to get very concerned about it, and they have already changed the codes of practice.
A place that already does a lot, actually, is California. I used to live in California. And I remember that I was living in a building that had been built before the 1931 Long Beach earthquake. And while I was there, it was a five-story apartment building. It was one of only about 6,000 multi-story buildings left in the greater Los Angeles area. But while I was there, they refitted the building by driving bolts through the exterior wall into the floor all the way around it, because regulations took effect, and they were the last to take effect were pre-1931 buildings. But so every building, even an old building, had to be retrofitted to meet the earthquake code. So you do have very strong earthquake codes in some places. I remember during Fukushima, I spoke to the world's leading expert on earthquake resistance for nuclear reactors. And he said the surprising thing about Hong Kong that stands out internationally is that it has tight typhoon standards, but it doesn't have any earthquake standards, and typhoon standards don't give you any protection against earthquakes. Next. Tom.
Thank you very much. Tom Holland from the South China Morning Post. Mr. Fitt, you're clearly right that if there were a major earthquake in Hong Kong, the effects through liquefaction, landslides, etc., would be absolutely devastating. But there's a reason we don't have standards, and that's because every assessment so far have concluded that the chances of a major earthquake are extraordinarily low. I mean, you mentioned, for example, the Shenzhen fault, which is, I believe, on the Luanshan fault zone. Last time that was active was in the Cretaceous, about 100 million years ago. You mentioned the Manila Trench. I'm sure you're aware of the study by Arup and Hong Kong University in 2008, which concluded the chances of a magnitude 7 or greater event is about 1.5% over the next 50 years. The reason nobody's particularly concerned about this is because the chances are vanishingly small. Isn't that right?
No, it's absolutely incorrect. The reason we're not concerned about it is because it's inconvenient. People can't deal with change. And the worst people of the lot are government servants, civil engineers, architects. They cannot cope with change because it's inconvenient. Quite literally. You said no movement along the Shenzhen fault. Well, here's some of the evidence for you yourself. You can see this cluster of... no one is blasting up there. Okay, that's micro-seismic activity in the Pearl River.
Micro-seismic activity of around magnitude 3, that's a good sign.
It's tiny, but it's moving. That's my whole point.
Well, that's a good sign that we're not going to get major seismic activity, because if it's moving, then we have no locked zones which are likely to generate a big earthquake.
Our records are very short indeed, considering the scale of what we are. Okay? Our records, they say that the Chinese have lots of records. The Chinese didn't know they'd mapped the world in 1421. The Chinese records is not a good historical record. Our records only started when the British came here in any sincerity, and then only in, I've forgotten, 1930s or something like this. Okay? We've had big earthquakes up and down the coast, along this coastline. I mentioned Shantou and so on, Hainan. We've had earthquakes on our doorstep here, 1874. What I'm saying is there's change occurring. There'd no earthquakes in, there's been plenty of mid-plate earthquakes have occurred in localities. The problem here is it would be inconvenient for us if they should they occur. I've answered all your questions. Sorry, there was a lot in you.
Well, I mean, I was just wondering, let's put it this way, what probability would you estimate for a major earthquake, let's say 6 or 7 magnitude within 100 kilometres of Hong Kong over the next 50 to 100 years?
Okay, put it this way, it could happen tomorrow. The answer is, I don't know, but I also pragmatically state the Hong Kong government doesn't know either. They have not drilled any deep boreholes. They have not measured state of in-situ stress along some of these major fault lines that have pinpointed. Okay? We just don't know. What we do know is what the risk is, what the consequences, as you said yourself, Tom, would be should we have a large earthquake. And that is the exact same position as in New York, where the authorities are taking it seriously. Would you allow your daughter at night to cross Hennessy Road naked, blindfolded? Would you? Why not? Because you wouldn't put your daughter, you wouldn't allow her, if she was of age, young enough, to take that sort of risk. There are some things we don't do. We have 7 million people here. We have such a valuable asset. We cannot afford to take risks with such big assets.
Over here, please.
You've mentioned Wanchai a few times. I'm not quite sure I get the relation between earthquakes. But what you did mention that I found quite interesting was the correlation between dam building and earthquakes, and you mentioned that
yes.
may have contributed to Sichuan. Could you please expand on that? I find that to be very interesting.
Fascinating. It's called reservoir-induced seismicity. There's 90 examples worldwide. Okay, the biggest... And one at He Yuan Dam, just up from Daya Bay, to the northeast of Daya Bay. They started filling that up, I think it was back in 1960, 1970, and they constantly had seismic activity, micro seismic activity, Tom, up until they stopped filling it. Okay? The biggest one at that time, I think, was 6.3. Sorry, 90 cases around the world of this happening. The biggest one was 6.3 until Sichuan. Sichuan is the biggest implied event. Obviously, people are not putting themselves out on a limb. The Scientist magazine said this filling of this reservoir may have caused this fault to become active. Okay? Well, with the legal aspects of the deaths of 69,000 people at stake, no one wants to jump in there and say that this is definitely the cause and blame the local authorities. But I think logically the two events are tied together very closely. I could show you a table with all the list of reservoirs. It goes back from 1938. There's a lot in China more recently because they've been building big dams in China, India. It is worldwide, 90 clear examples.
Okay. Over here, please.
Yes, sir.
I'm Tohan Chi from the South China Morning Post. Following up this theme about dams and earthquake, could you elaborate more? Because China is building most of the world's dams right now, both in China and all over the world. Given that fact, do you think China's intense dam building activity is going to increase the risk of earthquakes in Hong Kong, China, and the rest of the world? Could you elaborate, please?
It will certainly increase the risk of earthquakes occurring in China. Remember what I said about earthquakes. They are a local event. Sorry, that's not a very good slide to make as a presentation. It just illustrates there's an awful lot of cases. I believe during the building of the Three Gorges Dam, wasn't it the president of China expressed some concern about the potential effect on local seismicity? The answer is, I first discovered this when they went to China. The local geologists and seismologists are extremely concerned about the scale of the dams that they're building and the effect on seismicity. So it's happened a lot. He Yuan is the closest to Hong Kong.
You're saying it's a fact.
It's established. It's a whole area of scientific study. But up until Sichuan, it said Sichuan was 7.9 on the Richter scale. Yeah, it was the biggest single event, assuming what Scientist magazine has implied.
But even even Western seismologists have not agreed that was linked. But there are a lot of other studies. For example, they studied Taipei 101, and they had lots and lots of microquakes right after it was built in its immediate vicinity. The question is whether dam or man-made activity can trigger a large quake, and that's still unproven, isn't it?
Sichuan's the case in hand.
Well, that's the question, but it's not proven, or it's debated, yeah.
Well, let's call it a big coincidence.
Yeah. Up here, please.
that on? I'm Alan Piper from First City. In the unlikely event that the next chief executive appoints you to advise on earthquake mitigation...
In the highly unlikely event...
Understanding what Tom said about... Keith said about bolting walls to floors in California, what are you going to advise the government, the administration here, to do to safeguard us against, let's say, a magnitude 7 quake in 3 years' time?
I think I listed it here. First of all, we have to know more at depth of our geology.
No, I understand that. Sorry to interrupt you, but to save time, specifically, what are you going to do to protect us in our homes?
Okay. That's quite a challenge. In your homes might be, it depends on the state of your building and how old it is and so on. Don't think, as specifically mentioned in this in the book, I don't think that I could recommend knocking down a fair proportion of a 60,000 buildings. No city can do that. They have started studies, and bless their little hearts, the Building Ordnance Office has started to look at buildings which are unsafe. Some of them have started falling down. Okay? You guys report it. I would start at the studies, then I would look at new buildings. You start with new buildings always, okay? Most of them are going to be safe anyway. It's the ones that were built a lot more cranky back in the 50s, 60s. You remember we were building 87,000 flat... I may have got the figures wrong here. How many flats per year were we building then? You know, we were building in periods when there was no water... They used seawater in the concrete, a big no-no. That we use the short piles. There's issues. I've inspected some of these buildings. These buildings exist. A lot of them have been improved in somehow or other. I would go for the safe havens. I would say, let's have rock caverns around Hong Kong. You can build those. You can link them to underground structures. A little bit like Singapore, but we've got an even better geology for that. We can put storage of materials. You remember how I showed you that list of materials from the Government Logistics Centre? Okay, there's an ideal way of... First of all, you don't have one Government Logistics Centre. You have multiple centres, obviously, so you spread your risk. Then you can store, as I mentioned, first aid facilities, containers... water purification, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As far as your building is concerned, I don't know your building. I'm sorry. you might like to consider storing food. I know people who are doing that. I'm not suggesting it. I don't suggest you rush off to the supermarket. All I'm saying is this is not your responsibility. This is government's collective responsibility. And you must remember, consequence is to you, as far as the Hong Kong government, is multiplied by 7 million. That's their collective responsibility.
With that, we have time for one more question. Two questions quickly. Joel, and then our second guest, we'll just combine these two.
I'm posing the question as Secretary General of the IPPF. I'm Joel Laker. In Basel, Switzerland, got leveled in 1740 by a massive earthquake. But it had another earthquake just recently when boreholes were drilled to bring up heat, to heat the sidewalks, and it caused another earthquake.
So which country are you in?
Basel, Switzerland.
Oh, Switzerland.
About 2 years ago. Right. But that was due to geothermal exploration, which you did not touch on. And there's a lot of geothermal activity and development in China. Obviously, we have to be careful with it. We think it's a very important form of future energy. But would you be looking at geothermal with some of your future investigations? How to avoid possible earthquakes? What just happened in Basel, Switzerland?
And over here is the other question.
Okay.
And over here, please.
Sorry, let me give a short answer to that question.
Okay, sure.
I don't know. I have hit hot water in one of our deep tunnels under Tai Mo Shan. So there is hot water around Hong Kong. It is not naturally there. It just travels from some other areas. But I don't know. Okay? I did say that my book was written to ask questions rather than to provide all of the answers. Yes, sir.
My question is a little bit related to the question that was asked before the last one, which really, you had said that a lot of the more modern buildings are of less concern. So I guess the question I have is, are the new high-rise buildings, if you talk ICC or IFC, these sorts of buildings, are they built to a world-class, not, it can't be earthquake-proof, but as earthquake-proof as perhaps the major skyscrapers in Tokyo or Osaka are being built?
Probably not. Our codes of practice do not require earthquake design for large buildings, irrespective of the size. Dams are protected, are built according to those standards. So all dams worldwide are, because of large water retaining structures. I had understood from the study that was recently carried out that they said that modern buildings are safer than the older ones and they would probably not be affected. But our codes of practice do not require any provision, other than dams, for any earthquake design. So the answer is no. They're not being built like they are in Tokyo or other areas of potential earthquake.
With that, I'd like to wrap up. Thanks to our guest. First of all, before any of you go, though, I wanted to tell you just about some of our upcoming events, particularly next week. We have the European Union's trade minister here on Thursday of next week. I'm stunned that it hasn't sold out, actually, because this is, to some extent, the European Union's response to the Xi Jinping visit to Washington on Tuesday night, our time, of next week, and they're planning it. So those of you who have not already signed up for the European Union's trade minister, it's all very relevant for any of you who might be in banking, because the trade minister is the one who's very strongly opposed Wen Jiabao's suggestion that China might help Europe financially if Europe is willing to dismantle its non-market economy designation of China for anti-dumping purposes. So that'll be a very interesting speech, lunch Thursday next week. Also Tuesday next week, we have Professor Michael de Gaulier with the latest survey results on Hong Kong's search for direction under the next chief executive. And finally, on February 22nd, we have an ambassador from the Swiss Foreign Ministry to talk about how Switzerland is trying to recover illegal assets. Yen, we like to give our guests something to remember the club by. Thank you all for coming.